The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Happy Friday, everybody. It is Friday. The weekend is just about here. Yay! You know, I had plans this weekend. You know, on the side, I've been doing painting these pet portraits. It's my pandemic silver lining. I've found out I could paint. Who knew? So I've been doing these pet portraits and really enjoying it. And for a while there, it was like a nonstop. You know, I'd finish one project and someone else would contact me and ask me to paint their pet. So it was like a steady stream. I was never overwhelmed with them, but there was always one going on until a few weeks ago and it dried up. Well, then I saw that there's an event. I live in the town of Coral Springs, Florida, and there's an event that happens every year in July. They call it Christmas in July, and it's a crafts show. So I thought, what a good idea. I can go there and get out in the community and let people know I do this and maybe sell some more work, because I try to supplement my income however I can. You know, I'm here. This is my job, but we're supported on a voluntary basis. And I'm hoping if you listen to the show regularly and enjoy it and can afford it, you contribute. I know a lot of people aren't in the position to do so, and that's why I won't put it behind a paywall. So I do supplement my income in other ways. I do voiceover work, and now I also paint. But now I'm in Florida, where we are leading the nation in new COVID infections. David, my husband, is a bit overprotective, but I get it. And for reasons I'll tell you about in just a moment, I am particularly susceptible. Not susceptible to get the infection, but if I do get COVID, the consequences could be very severe because of what I went through 5 years ago. So I came up with a solution. I had made up these flyers, and so I'm going to go before they open up. I'm going to set up a display on my table, and I'm going to leave my flyers and a little video playing and business cards and a note saying why I'm not there. And if anybody's interested in a pet portrait, to call me. So hopefully they'll take the flyers and the business cards and sort of, it's a compromise. So I'm doing that this weekend, but I will not sit in this, it's a ballroom, a hotel ballroom for, you know, 4 hours, even masked, because I don't want to risk infection. So I'm going to do that. But as to why I'm so susceptible, well, this week was a big anniversary. It was 5 years ago. I thought it was today because I was looking at my calendar and I realized that a major post disappeared from my website. So today is July 23rd. I thought the fifth anniversary of this diagnosis I got, it was July 21st. So I missed it by 2 days. You know, I've been doing this. I've been doing, obviously, radio since 1979, but I've been doing this talk radio thing, I don't know, 15 years now or something. And a little over 5 years ago, I was working with Randy Rhodes. She decided to come back on the air, do her own show like I was doing. We decided we'd work together in the same studio. So we found studio space in Delray Beach and we built it out and we started broadcasting from there. It didn't go very well. I'll just put it right there. It didn't go very well. And so something that happened there, well, I'm going to play the tape. I'm going to play for you the video from 5 years ago, Wednesday, not 5 years ago today, but 5 years ago, 2 days ago, so you can see what happened. I have always been very open with my audience. I don't keep secrets from you. So this will explain why I'm particularly careful about not being exposed to people potentially with COVID. So let's get in the Wayback Machine and go back to July 21st, 2016.
So the reason I wasn't here yesterday was I went in for a biopsy of my lung. Now, if you don't know what's been going on for the last couple of weeks, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago today, actually, just was not a good day all around. And
that was
I wasn't
the day I'm talking
right.
about.
Just something was off all day. When I got home, all I wanted to do was lie down and go to sleep, which I did. And I awoke after an hour or two, drenched in sweat. I mean, really just pouring off of me, with pain in my jaw. And when I got up, I was lightheaded and sort of dizzy and short of breath. And the pain in my jaw, I realized, was on the left side and going down my left arm, which women, those are the classic heart attack symptoms for women. I'll tell you, one of the more disconcerting thing is the last couple of weeks I've been in and out of hospitals and having tests. And, you know, they also, when they see heart attack, everyone goes, oh, so you had chest pain? No, I didn't have chest pain. And women, when you're having a heart attack, most of the time you don't have chest pain. The symptoms for women are different. And I'm just telling you this because most people who I tell this story have no idea. For women, heart attack symptoms are different. But if you find you have pain on your jaw, especially on the left side, going down your left arm, if you're short of breath, if you're lightheaded and dizzy and sweating profusely, go to the emergency room. All right, so the signs were that I was having a heart attack. They kept me overnight, and of course, one of the markers for a heart attack is an enzyme called troponin is released into your blood, and my blood test showed an elevated level of troponin. So the next morning, that would be Friday, they transferred me to a different hospital that did an angiogram. The hospital I was in first didn't have the equipment there. So within the Broward Health Medical Group, I'm leaving out a lot just to get to leaving out the insurance fights, fighting over the ambulance. By the way, got the bill yesterday. The ambulance costs like $600 and something. The communication, the transportation cost or the mileage cost was like $300 or something. Well, they wanted to send me to the hospital that was closer instead of the hospital where my cardiologist was. Long story short, you fight with the insurance company long enough and they eventually relent. Anyway, so I go for the angiogram. We find out I did not have a heart attack. In fact, thankfully, my heart is beautiful, as the cardiologist said. It's in perfect shape. My arteries are wide open and clear. There was no heart attack. There was no blockage, no need for a stent. But that's a big but. The x-ray of my heart my chest, to make sure that the heart wasn't enlarged, showed a mass on my left lung. So just so happens I had an appointment with a pulmonologist for the following Wednesday to deal with my sleep issues, because long-term listeners know I don't sleep, or I don't sleep well. So I thought, well, that's the lung doctor. Rather than stay in the hospital all weekend to maybe see a doctor on Monday, which I was not about to do, had the appointment with a pulmonologist on Wednesday, who immediately wanted to send me for a PET CT scan because it was concerning to him. Again, you know, I'm going to break in here for a second to tell you that when I went to the hospital because of the suspected heart attack where they did the x-ray, they never told me that the x-ray showed a mass on my lung. It wasn't until the next day when I was at the other hospital and I met with my cardiologist who was about to do the angiogram that he told me. He's the one who told me. They never told me at the first hospital. Lovely, right? So, this story just has so many layers. But all right, let's keep going. Let's keep going. This is 5 years ago this week. Insurance company balked at the PET scan. So, but if you ask three times, they'll let you have it.
They will.
That's a topic for another day. And boy, we'll get there. But the bottom line is, so then Monday morning, I went for the CT scan, the regular CAT scan. And I got to tell you, this doctor is great, because by the time I got up here to the studio, after, I put the disc in the computer to look at it and having no idea what the hell I'm looking at other than it was scary. He called and he said, I just got, just looking at the images, and it is definitely a tumor. Now that's all we know because it's only a CT scan. So, it is a tumor. So we want to get this biopsied, as soon as possible. And we want to, now we can get you in for the PET scan as well. So the biopsy was scheduled for yesterday. The PET scan is scheduled for tomorrow morning. When I left there yesterday, I was under the impression I would not have any results until Monday for both tests. So I came up to work, getting ready. We've got, we've got a great show for you today. It's Thursday. It's Drift Glass Thursday. So he'll be on with us in a little while. Howie Klein, of course, on in the second hour.
Some things never change.
I will be here tomorrow. That said, and I will be going in for the PET scan in the morning. But I got up here to the studio, a little after 12 o'clock this afternoon. It's now a little after 2. And shortly after I got here, my phone rang, and it was once again the doctor. And although I was not expecting any answers before Monday, the doctor was able to get the pathologist, whoever does, reads the tests. And they got a preliminary results from the biopsy. And it's cancer. It's something called, he thinks it's adenocancer. Adenocarcinoma. So I still go in for the PET scan tomorrow. And we have an appointment for next Thursday with a surgeon. And waiting to hear back from the oncologist. So you guys are going through it with me because I don't know how to do it any other way. I will have to be open and honest and share everything with you because I don't know how else to do it.
Wow. 5 years ago.
I smoked when I was younger. My parents smoked. It was just, nobody really thought twice about it. I think back then it was before there was even warnings on cigarette packs. Neither of my parents had lung cancer. My father wound up dying after he was pushed and an accident left him quadriplegic, and he lived that way for 12 years. He was healthy as a horse. My mother died at 47. She had leukemia. And actually what killed her was a brain bleed. It was a brain hemorrhage. She had malignant melanoma. I had a melanoma about 10 years ago, and I thought, that'll get me. Never thought I'd live past 47 because that's how old she was when she died. Now, the good news, and I don't know anything. This is the problem. I mean, I'm glad the doctor called with the early... as soon as he knew something, he called me, which is, I can't ask for anything more than that. But he's a pulmonologist. He doesn't do surgery. He's not an oncologist. So he is with the Holy Cross group in Fort Lauderdale, which is listed on the Lung Cancer Alliance for Florida as really the only place in Fort Lauderdale they have. And their program is very highly respected. I just never thought, you never think this is going to happen to you. So I grew up, of course, my parents smoked. So I started smoking at, the ripe old age of 12. We thought we were cool. We'd ride over to, we lived in a very nice neighborhood in Hollywood, Florida. And, we'd ride our bicycles to this trailer park, like across Sterling Road, and cigarettes in the machine were 55 cents a pack. This had to have been, 73, maybe 74, somewhere in there. And we'd buy cigarettes and we thought we were so cool. I quit smoking when I was about 30. So I smoked for a good 15 years or a little more. Quit smoking when I was about 30. And when I worked with Mark and Brian at KLOS, I was sort of forced into it because they smoked and I smoked, and we'd be in that studio together every morning. When we moved into a new building, they built us this new building, and when we moved into the new building, they said you can't smoke in there anymore. So during the commercials, the guys would go out and smoke cigarettes, and I had to run the board, so I didn't get to go. And that's when I said, "Fuck it, I'm quitting." So, so here we are. And when I first heard the news of the mass on my lung, I thought, as so many people said to me, they came out of the woodworks and said, I had something like that, or my brother had something like that, and, oh, it's nothing. Don't worry. Everybody's saying, don't worry.
A lot of people said
it's
that.
Nothing. It's nothing. And at the beginning, I felt like that, too. I felt like that until I met with the pulmonologist on Wednesday of last week. And I told you that day I got scared. And after that, I'm just going to tell you this. And I know everybody who has said to me, don't worry, it's going to be okay, that you mean well. Now, as the person on the receiving end, I implore you, please don't tell me not to worry. And for all the people who've been saying, oh, it's nothing, I had something just like that, it's nothing, don't do that. It's not helpful. Okay. And I'm saying this with love and appreciation. For the next time, don't say that. Just say, just empathize. Okay. Don't try to make it better for me because you can't. And don't try to tell somebody not to worry because you can't. It just is. So, I'll keep you posted. The next step, waiting again, the pulmonologist said he was going to call the oncologist and try to get me in as soon as possible. And I have the appointment with the surgeon on Thursday. Now, the other thing that my the pulmonologist said was that if there's no evidence of a metastatic disease, in other words, if it's localized in the lung right there and hasn't spread, which I guess the PET scan will tell us tomorrow, that the best thing to do is just remove the lobe. He said, you're young, relatively, and healthy, I guess all things in, you know, moderation. He said, but for someone as, you know, healthy as you and as young as you, we go for the full cure, and that's removing the lobe. So I have no idea what the next few months will bring. But I'll try to hold my stuff together and, you know, keep going because it's the only thing I can do. You know, you realize that working helps me because, you know, if I didn't, I'd be climbing the walls and, you know, even more of a mess than I am now. So, you know, luckily we have a big circus keeping us occupied this week and we've got another one next week.
Oh, the conventions.
So that's the story. All right. I'm going to take a break. Sort of clean myself up, and we're going to move on, and we're going to talk about the convention and the madness and just, oh my God, the things that people find important. I guess, you know, everything in everything on its own course. I don't know. Anyway, we'll take a break and come back on the other side with stuff, whatever. Thank you for being here today. All right. And we'll be right back. I'm Nicole Sandler. Don't go away.
And that was 5 years ago. Not today. It was 5 years ago, 2 days ago. And wow. I remember that as if it were yesterday. And there's somebody in the chat room now who was diagnosed with lung cancer about 6 months after I was, apparently. And she's still fighting the good fight. Shadow, I'm telling you, I gave you my email address. Write to me. I will give you my phone number. You can call anytime. Because it's very lonely going through that. The good news is, you heard what they said, I did have the lobectomy. They not only removed the lower lobe of my left lung, but did a wedge resection of the upper lobe of my left lung because there was a second tumor there. And the doctors were afraid that it had metastasized and that was a spread. Turns out I had two separate and distinct tumors. They were not related. One was not a metastasis of the other. They were two instances of lung cancer growing in the upper lobe and the lower lobe of my left lung. So that's one of the reasons why I'm not going to this thing on Sunday, because I'm missing a lung. And, you know, it's a respiratory disease. COVID hits your lungs. So if I were to get it, even though I've been vaccinated and I've been very careful, it could be devastating. So I will not go to this event this weekend. I will do the responsible thing. But what they told me when I had the surgery, because it had not spread, because it was stage one, we caught it really early, that not a heart attack I had from a day of stress at the office, wound up saving my life because we caught it so early. I did not need chemo. I did not need radiation. I just had my chest cut open and, you know, my left lung removed. And what they told me at the time was, we never use the word cured in cancer unless if you make it through 5 years with all clean scans, we will consider you cured. Well, guess what? The 5-year anniversary of my surgery is August 30th. I go in for my final scan, I think in 2 weeks,
And then the following week, I will have my appointment with the oncologist, and I fully expect it to be clear, and I expect them to tell me I'm cured. I did find out, though, the last time I was there, that even once you pass the five-year mark, you still have to keep getting scans. But the first year, I got four. I got them every 3 months. Then after, I think, 2 years, they did it. They knocked it down to three times a year, and then it was twice a year. After this scan in a couple of weeks, I'll still have to go in yearly for an annual scan. But the difference is it won't be with contrast. It won't be with radiation. It'll just be a standard CT scan. And if anything looks suspicious, then they'll do the contrast and the radiation. But I look at how I was on that day 5 years ago, and it really makes you take stock and realize what's important. And I think back to that day. Oh, my God. It was on the eve of the conventions. I still couldn't believe that Donald Trump would be president. and you know, look what happened. I wound up moving back to my home studio. I stayed on the air until about a week or so before the surgery. And then I took some time off afterwards. Well, then it's like September. Okay, so my surgery was in was August 30th. And all September, I'm home and I'm recuperating. And by October, I'm like, there's an election on November 8th. And I need to be on the air for this. So finally worked it out with the Progressive Voices people. And I went back on the air, and I've been doing it ever since. So here we are. And again, you realize what's important. But having that dichotomy going, dealing with lung cancer, and then dealing with the possibility and then eventuality, the reality that Donald Trump was going to be president, it did a number on me. But anyway, so that's, you know, that's what this show is about. So you guys have been through it all with me from the lung cancer diagnosis 5 years ago. I you know, watching that video, it's you can't help but get emotional, right? You go back to that slice of life, and it's just overwhelming. But I can't. I need to thank you all for bearing with me. As I said at the time, I have to do it with you guys because it's the only way I know how to do this. I have, you know, spoken into a microphone and communicated with this group of listeners who have become like family for longer than I care to admit. And when I got that diagnosis, I knew there was no question but that I was going to come on the air an hour later and tell you guys what happened and say that, you know, we will go through it together because that's the only way I know how to do this. And I did. And it's because of you guys that I'm able to keep going. So, and that I'm able to be supportive. So when I see somebody in the chat room, Shadow, who is also still dealing with lung cancer, I got really, really lucky. The fact that I had a bad experience at work that made me feel like I was having a heart attack that sent me to the hospital. Otherwise, what the doctors told me was, we rarely see it in people your age. When we do finally get someone in here with a lung cancer diagnosis, it's usually too far along to have a good prognosis. But with me, we caught it early. I was the unicorn. I was the rare one. Believe me, I was far from young 5 years ago, right? But in the world of lung cancer, I was. So anyway, here we are. I got two more hurdles to get through, right? The CAT scan in 2 weeks, the appointment with the oncologist the week later, and then August 30th, the day I will be 5 years lung cancer free, and then we really can party. All right? All right. But please, if you ever smoked in your life, go get screened. I hadn't smoked in 20 years when I was diagnosed, so much so that they considered me a non-smoker because I had quit when I was 30, and when I was diagnosed, I was 50 something. So get screened. It's as simple. Get a chest x-ray. That's how we found my spot. And so just do it. You'll sleep better at night. All right. Speaking of sleeping better at night, even once I was clear from the cancer, unfortunately, I didn't sleep well at night because a couple of months later was election day. You know, my birthday was November 4th, came through the surgery. I'm back on the air. I could not go through this election without being able to talk about what was going on, because that's what I do. And then all I could think was, wow, be careful what you wish for. Because as we know, what happened, the inexplicable, the unbelievable, the thing that could never in a million years have happened, Donald Trump is elected president. And again, those of you who've been with me this long know that I had a very bad reaction to that, and I did not do well that entire first year of the Trump presidency. Now, looking back on it in retrospect, it's sort of like looking back on the cancer. Both were sort of a cancer. I'm still amazed that we made it out kind of in one piece. But, you know, there was a lot of damage done along the way. And now that we're 6 months into Joe Biden's presidency, there is a, it seems like the floodgates have opened with the books coming out. Now, there were books throughout Trump's term that came out, and we saw the vitriol he levied upon the people who wrote the books. But something interesting happened when he was out of office. I guess this is a sign of a narcissist. He couldn't help himself. And so he found out these people, many of whom he had excoriated in public, who had he had called the worst names imaginable, he agreed to sit for interviews with them. And so I want to bring in our guest today. I'm excited to meet him. I've never spoken to Michael C. Bender before, but I'm thrilled that he's joining us today. Michael C. Bender is the senior White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and his book, Frankly, We Did Win This Election, The Inside Story of How Trump Lost, was released last week, and you entered the New York Times bestseller list at number 3, right? Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been really overwhelming, the response the book has gotten this past week. It's been really, really nice.
I'll bet. And I got to say, I've seen you everywhere. So you must be so sick of doing these interviews by now. So-
no, I mean, I no, I'm not. I'm enjoying it. I mean, I spent so long and spent so many hours working on that book and, you know, nights away from my family and softball games away from my daughter and put so much on, you know, everyone's life had been overturned and everyone's routine was upset by the pandemic and everyone's stress levels were already increased. And here I was asking, you know, the people I love the most to help to shoulder even more. By the time I handed this book in, I was just hoping I wasn't going to embarrass them myself, but mostly them, the people who really helped me. And so for them, it's been really nice. They've been sharing in my, you know, in the celebration here, and my family came in for some of the book party, and you know, everyone's really excited, and so it's nice for them, for me to see them feeling like that was you know,
it was all worth it.
That paid off. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I can't even imagine what the last 5 years have been like for you. I mean, I just, you heard the tail end of my story. Five years ago, I was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Yeah.
Here I am 5 years later, knocking on wood laminate that all is well.
No, it's really, I did catch the tail end of it. I mean, it's a really inspirational story, and I'm glad that you're doing well, and it's a really good message and reminder to be checked and to pay attention, you know, to these sorts of things and to not smoke.
Right. And to take precautions, because as you rightly said, we are in the midst of the never ending pandemic and COVID. And I live in Florida. Thank you very much. So while I was feeling a little more comfortable, I got vaccinated as soon as I could. I wear a mask. Yeah. I rarely leave the house, but I thought, okay, now we can start. Well, now we can't. And I was supposed to do this event this weekend that I'm not going to because I have one lung, you know, so there are other people who won't get vaccinated, who won't wear a mask. There are people like me out there who have one lung and have autoimmune issues or have other issues that they're putting those people at risk. And that's just not okay. If you want to kill yourself, that's one thing, but don't do it to us.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. And I do think like it, that it makes us in some ways the book even more pressing right now, that it's not really, I mean, we're still going through all this, right? And, and one of the things that this book does is when it comes to COVID, I kind of come at, come at this presidency in this past year in a few different angles. But on COVID, I mean, you know, the people around him were worried about, you know, that he was putting his own health at risk, and the people around him, their health at risk, yeah. to say nothing of the public health that he was putting at risk.
You know, we'll get back, we'll jump back to the beginning, but since we're on this subject, mm-hmm. when he was diagnosed with COVID, when he walked out to Marine One, mm-hmm. you could tell that he was not well, but we yeah. didn't know how sick he was. And apparently yeah. he was really, really sick. Is he so, well, he is so, he's so concerned with his image, how he appears to other people, that that's mm-hmm. his main concern, not the fact that I should model good behavior and let people know if they're not feeling well to, you know, do the right thing here. Yeah. Instead, everything with him is an act. Everything is show business. Everything mm-hmm. is the image, not the reality.
Yeah, I mean, I should say here that there has rarely been a president, Democrat or Republican. All of Trump's predecessors, when they were sick or when they had issues, hit it to some degree from public view.
Sure,
FDR. As Trump did this time. Right. And, you know, that's not to say that it's right mm-hmm. or that it's, you know, but that has been the sort of MO of presidents for a long time.
That's true.
I think mm-hmm. this book gives us the fullest accounting so far about what was happening behind the scenes when he was diagnosed, how he got diagnosed, when he actually took his first test. You know, I reported here for the first time that he had received some false positives,
right?
Before testing positive, ultimately, or the positive test that we all know about, and how sick he was. And I should just sort of pause here too to say that I think there is more to know. I think that the full extent of this isn't really understood by the public yet. But yeah, I mean, several people around Trump, Trump loyalists believe that he tested positive the morning before he flew to Bedminster for a
yeah,
fundraiser.
Right.
You know, that's in dispute, but again, the fact that there is no single accounting of what happened that day is pretty telling about how this president operated in the White House, and the extent of what he was, how sick he got. I mean, you mentioned, him trying to put on airs that he was healthier than and stronger than he was feeling, and that's certainly the case, and that aligns with what his image and that he wants to project. But I have a scene in here that sort of gets to that, which is, you know, as he wants to project his own strength, he carries his own bag. Right. Into Walter Reed, and as soon as he gets behind closed doors there, in private, he drops it. And as soon as he drops it, everyone around him instinctively takes a step backwards because he's sick with COVID right. and contagious at this point. And after a beat, it was Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, who leans forward, picks up the bag, and shrugs and carries it into the room. And Trump tells him, "That was the moment, Mark, where I knew you were my guy." So,
oh God.
So this is the level of loyalty he's looking for from staff.
Right. So let's back up to the beginning again. Michael C. Sure. Bender's our guest. The book, frankly, we did win this election. You decided that the book would cover the period between impeachments, from yeah. impeachment to impeachment. But you covered mm-hmm. the Trump White House from the beginning. You were the guy for the Wall Street Journal in the briefing room in the White House every day, yes?
That's correct. Yep. I covered Trump. I joined the Journal in 2016. So my quick background is I've been a journalist for about two dozen years. I worked at newspapers in Colorado, Ohio, Florida, covering night cops, county commissions, state legislatures, until I came to Washington about 10 years ago, a little less. And I've been with the Journal since 2016, covering Trump.
Oh, wow.
And you know, one kind of interesting sort of aside here is I was one of like a team of five reporters who were covering Trump in 2016. And we all thought Hillary was going to win.
Everybody did.
Yeah. And when Trump did win, they wanted, my editors wanted some people to come who knew Trump and who knew his people to come into the White House. And every single one of my other colleagues
said no,
not just said no, but said no way.
Wow.
Right? There was, And what it was the unpredictability, right? Of like, you know, they had, we'd all spent the better part of a year kind of at our schedules and our family lives at Trump's whims, right? And we're, you know, he's capable of making news around the clock and wants to do just that. And, you know, I watched many of my colleagues, there are different breaking points of just not the politics, right? I'm not really talking, but just the onslaught of, you know, information or news that he was making could get overwhelming.
And the lies. See, that's what I get. You know, during the campaign, it was apparent the man was a narcissist and a liar. And, you know, but we knew that about him. I grew up in New York. You knew it. Donald Trump was Donald Trump. And the thought that he could ever become president was just so absurd.
Yeah.
And then when it happened, it was like a gut punch. And then there you are covering the White House for the Wall Street Journal. And so he makes the change from candidate to president. Did you for a moment think that he could possibly rise to the occasion and have a somewhat normal presidency, that he could rein in his lies and narcissism?
You know, it's a good question. I'm trying to remember it. Like, I don't remember any like particular moment where I thought like kind of pondered like his whether he was capable of doing that or not. I mean, I do remember thinking quite specifically about, I mean, that's certainly what about the mandate he had been elected with. Right. I mean, it's it was not unlike Barack Obama. I mean, they are two very different men, two very different politicians, but both were elected as change agents. Right. And the country had put their hopes in each of these men to change the way things were done in Washington. And I do remember thinking about whether, like, you know, what the potential he had, Trump had early on, to be a really transformational figure, right? Because he does a couple things. Well, he does a lot of things differently. But, you know, at the start, if there's a few things done differently, you know, he would have had, I think, a lot of support. I mean, if you start with infrastructure or some sort of like outreach to the other side, instead of catering to the Republican establishment that you'd spent a year running against,
right,
could have been a different story. But to your point, that would have required, you know, as we learned, just a totally different person.
A knowledge of history, which he obviously doesn't possess. But, you know, you look at his past. He used to be a Democrat. I don't know if it was in your book or another one. I'm so sorry, because they all came out at the same time. But I did hear, you know, so I read something recently that he at one point said he was ready for a health care system that would have put.
Yeah, that was in this book. I mean,
okay.
What I did back is I did go back and look at his like the when he got close to or was sort of teasing presidential runs in the late 80s and then more seriously in 2000 and 2012. And I was struck by a number of things, which is why I included a lot of this in the book, is I'm convinced that he was close to running both times. I mean, he was sort of dismissed pretty widely in both instances as kind of a showman and just a sort of publicity stunt. But I don't think that those are separated in Trump's mind. I think it's kind of all of a piece. And he was saying the same sorts of things back then that he was now, or different versions of the same kind of message. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, he was talking about, you know, a sort of a tax the rich program when he was thinking about running for a reform party.
Yes.
You know, and what's, you know, that those details changed quite a bit by 2016, but what doesn't change is his, I mean, that's populism, right?
Populism.
He's looking,
yes.
Yeah. And that's what he's interested in. And that's the sort of his path to the White House and that celebrity that he has is through populism. And, you know, there's darker sides here too, right? I mean, one of the things I do is delineate very clearly what happened in 2012 with the birtherism stuff and how Sean Hannity put it on his show night after night after night after night after night. I mean, I go through like how many times he referenced it, how much, you know, doing segments on it, asking guests about the birtherism issue, and you know, helped, you know, push Trump to the top of the polls that year, which a lot of people forget.
Right. Now, you also, the point, though, that I was making, you wrote mm-hmm. about he wanted to have this great healthcare system that would have mm-hmm. put, I don't know, Michael Moore to shame or some, I forget who you cited, somebody mm-hmm. to shame, because it was going to be so, you know, socialistic, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was Teddy Kennedy.
It was Teddy Kennedy. It would put Teddy Kennedy to shame. And then, you know, he used to be pro-choice. I mean, this mm-hmm. the thing about Donald Trump is he doesn't have an ideology. He's whatever is going to propel him the furthest, whatever he thinks will get him further along. And he realized this birther crap caught on, and mm-hmm. he found the audience at Fox, and he just went further and further to the right. I think a lot of people who, you know, were Obama voters first and then voted for him, maybe thought, you know, he used to be a Democrat. Maybe he's not such a Republican. Maybe he will do something different.
Yeah, so I think that's right. Right. And his sort of coarseness and his willingness to, you know, attack, you know, an American hero like John McCain.
Right.
Right. And go after, you know, the parents
the gold star parents, right? The cons. Yeah,
correct. I mean, in a weird way, that was reinforced the view of for a lot of people that Trump was willing to say and do anything, and he'll say and do anything for us.
Yeah, but
right?
No.
And not yeah, I mean, it played out a little differently. And I think that's one of the things that this book does is, you know, we know this, I try to add as much context as I can of what it was like to be there. Right. I mean, I wrote 1100 stories for the Wall Street Journal
wow.
about Donald Trump. And I don't want to read another one of those, right? Like I wanted to write something where that I would want to read that, that you don't have to be a you know, in the weeds, on politics or Washington to understand and find interesting. And so I was injecting a lot of my experiences and in context of what it's been like to cover him. And then I was shocked when I actually, you know, was able to do some of the reporting of this after the election and found, you know, how many people around Trump, you know, it wasn't the chaos that we all were aware of that they were worried about. It was how dangerous they thought he'd become, you know, in his desperation to hold on to power, which was really the striking part for me, and what I think is one of the new things that this book offers.
Right. Now, it's good to know that those people were there. I mean, for a while there, we thought the only ones were, you know, the guy who wrote the anonymous column and then book.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that wasn't enough. And I wondered, and John Kelly, I finally got the feeling, though I wasn't a fan of his, that he was staying around to keep him somewhat in line if he could. But then I wondered about the other people, the Kellyanne Conways and the, mm-hmm. you know, the other people who were his enablers. And the fact that they were enabling him. They weren't holding him back. Are you saying some of those people who we looked at as his sycophants, his enablers, mm-hmm. his minions, were actually trying to keep him in line because they were afraid of what he might do?
To a degree, I mean, I think they kind of fall in two camps. One is I was struck by how many people viewed themselves around Trump as the truth tellers, as the people who were, would describe themselves as I was the one who, you know, wouldn't sugarcoat things for Trump, when the reality was, you know, in my reporting showed was that most of them actually were, right? Like there were that their suggestions or when they were trying to tell Trump no or suggest he do something differently, those messages were sort of nested inside a lot of affirmation for Trump. You know, the instance I have in the book is when Pence was going back and forth over what to do on January 6th and tells
right.
Trump, you know, I don't think I have the authority to do this, but we'll certainly look at whatever your lawyers come up with. Right. And Trump hears the second part of that,
of course,
which is what happens a lot around Trump. I do think some of the characters I think that come to, you know, that I kind of, you know, to talk about and really reveal for the first time here are in this vein as sort of guardrails for Trump are Mark Milley, the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman, and also I think Ronna McDaniel, the chairwoman of the Republican Party. And this is getting in the weeds now of the book, but the Florida, Trump's top staffer in Florida for the campaign is a woman by the name of Susie Wiles. And she has a direct line to him by the end of the race and is telling him, a more closer version of reality than Trump wants to acknowledge sometimes. And, I think, what was striking about this was how difficult and all consuming that this job really was, keeping Trump in line, especially when you consider how dangerous they viewed him. Right. I mean, he's telling them that he wants to shoot Americans.
Yes.
Right. I mean,
the protesters. He wanted to shoot the protesters.
Who were peacefully protesting George Floyd's death, broader abuses of civil rights and civil justice. He wants them shot in the leg, shot in the foot, their skulls cracked to teach him a lesson and to restore some sense of law and order. And this is not a one-off. These are things that he had repeated to them over and over again. Bringing uniformed military.
Yeah.
This is, again, I mean, the difference between bringing in the National Guard, who are trained as, as kind of law, quasi law enforcement, domestic, law enforcement officials for specific things like protests, but he wants to bring in uniformed military active duty soldiers who are trained to kill. They're trained to kill and take land.
Right.
I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. Right. And, obviously people like Mark Milley and Attorney General Bill Barr and even, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, to varying degrees, with varying degrees of success, are the ones who are telling him that this is, unacceptable.
Right. I think Mark Milley is the man most responsible for us still standing here today, for saving us from Trump's worst instincts. I think, I'm just, I'm very far removed. Michael C. Bender, you're there in the room, and it's even more than you're talking about the hard work for the people who surrounded him. I got to ask about the hard work of covering this White House. And it's not only you, a lot of journalists can then go home and leave part of it at work. But your wife is Ashley Parker, who's the Washington bureau chief for the Washington Post, who also sat in that White House briefing room every day and was the object of his ire on many occasions. When you'd go home at night and you were out of the work mode, did you ever go, can you believe this is, what the fuck is going on here? Sorry, we're online. I can say what I want.
I mean, the answer is yes. I mean, it was like a blessing and a curse, right? It was both doing the same job. I mean, the difficult piece of that was we were competitors.
Right.
Right. And Ashley's the best in the business. So, that was a curse for me, who repeatedly came up on the short end of the stick whenever we were chasing the same details. But on the other side, which is kind of what you're asking about, is it was nice to, have a sort of some shared knowledge of our workday, right? And like the people in the White House and, sort of second or third tier staffers who, no one else had ever heard of before, or who you might have been irritated with or got in a fight.
Right.
You know, it was nice. Neither of us would have to sort of give the whole backstory of who that person was and why this matters. Right. Like we kind of pick up the story right.
You have a sympathetic ear, and they're already there. They already were briefed on the background situation. So,
yeah, exactly. And, I would be remiss to, she was she's the reason this book got done too. I mean, she, the amount I needed of help I needed for her to take over childcare, all the nights and, nights and weekends and dinners and breakfast and getting to school, getting to, daycares, all of that, all of the sort of like domestic responsibilities, to say nothing of, she's also, the White House bureau chief for the Washington Post, which is a all-consuming job, and an analyst on MSNBC.
Right.
And so, And she also read this book several times. And I'm just very, very lucky. It's a long way to say I'm very, very lucky and for to have her help and her support and, you know, to have a kind of, you know, my best editor, my best publicist and my best friend all wrapped up in one single person is really,
that's great.
You're very lucky.
You are lucky. You're fortunate to have that. Now, here's the other part of the question. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of criticism lobbed, not necessarily at you, but at the authors of these books.
Yeah.
And I think it goes back to, Bolton, because John Bolton wrote mm-hmm. this book, held on to it until he was able to publish it. And there mm-hmm. was news in there that the American mm-hmm. people really needed to know, deserved mm-hmm. to know, certainly before the election. But he held on to that in order to collect the paycheck, I guess, when these stories should have been told before that. You are a working journalist. Mm-hmm. You've written 1,100 stories about him for the Wall mm-hmm. Street Journal. Two questions. Did you hold anything back for the book? And two, Wall Street Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Did you ever get any pushback on anything critical of Trump?
I mean, the answer to both of those questions is no. The Bolton, I have, and you're right, I have gotten a lot of criticism on Twitter and sort of social media of people saying they're horrified that I would put this out now. I mean, the reality is, I mean, I work for a daily newspaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my job.
Right.
It's my sole source of income. And they would have a thing or two to say about the fact that I was holding things back.
Oh, sure. I would think
right?
so.
I mean, this
right.
is all, everything that's gotten earned headlines so far has been reporting I did after the election.
After
I took leave to work on the book. And you're right. There was the Bolton book that came out. And the other thing that I think is fueling a lot of this was the Woodward book in 2020 uh-huh. when he had the tapes about Trump.
Oh yeah, I forgot
hiding,
about that.
How contagious COVID was, and again the difference there is that Woodward is not a daily journalist, right?
Right.
I mean, he's an author, and you know, I mean, he and Bolton can explain their own decision making process, but certainly for me and I know other daily journalists who are doing the similar, undertaking similar tasks, there was no holding back. I mean, I was in a daily competition with some of the best journalists in the country.
Right, some who work with your wife.
while I was trying to represent one of the biggest papers in the country, so there was no question I was not holding any of this back for a book that, again, I didn't even know anyone was going to even see, right? Like no one,
right.
I've never written a book before. I don't have a very big social media presence. I'm not a celebrity. There's no reason, none of the sort of normal reasons people have to pick up a book by a first-time author, right? I mean, I was hoping I wasn't going to embarrass myself here. That's some of the backstory. And the Rupert Murdoch question too is a good one and a fair one. And, I've never had any, it felt like, I was being swayed one way or the other because of what the Murdochs may or may not want.
And unlike say the New York Post, where I think the editorial is influenced by the ideology, the Washington Post, the editorial page is one thing, but the reporting I've always thought has been top notch. So I haven't seen that stuff creep into the actual news reporting at the Wall Street Journal.
You're a nuanced reader. I mean, it's hard for people to understand the differences there. And which I respect, because an opinion, opinions and columns on one page and straight news on the other is, not a very, sometimes a very clear, delineation there, but that's true. And the Wall Street Journal's brand, has always been to play it down the middle, and sort of like, just the facts, ma'am type of reporting. Mm-hmm. And that tends also to sometimes feel conservative, to some people. So I think that's the other kind of hurdle we have, same thing. I mean, we have a very rigorous editing process, and it's not, to benefit one party or the other. It's to benefit it's to protect our own brand and our
sure.
own.
Well, yeah. And it's your name is on these stories. So you want it to be the truth. That's what a reporter is supposed mm-hmm. to do. Unlike, the propaganda, news outlets, I hate calling them news, Fox, for instance, or Newsmax or OAN, it's a whole different animal. you work in a news organization.
Right. I mean, it's a little scary now. I mean, I've been in the business, like I said, for 2 decades, and there's not much, there's not a whole lot of competition for that just kind of straight facts kind of journalism anymore. And there's not,
we need more of it. Actually,
yeah, I mean, it's obviously driven by consumers more than anything, but what they want and what they want to, you know, read. But it's a big, obviously a big changes since just I've been in the business.
Right. Michael, one last question for you. You did get to sit down with Donald Trump himself twice for this book, obviously after he left office, which is when you worked on it. Now, I don't recall any big run-ins you had with him. I know he complimented your hair because that's where his mind goes. But the, you know, and since the book's come out, he called you a third-rate journalist or something, which is to be expected. How was he when you met him? And does he have any, does he know he's lying or does he believe his own bullshit?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. I mean, and one that, and your last point there, about what he, if he actually believes this election was stolen from him. I don't know. And the people around him don't know. I mean, he kind of gives them different impressions on a day-to-day basis. I do know that most of my interviews, you've been down there twice, several hours. Most of the questions I asked, he brought back to missing ballots in Detroit or the fraud in Georgia or conspiracies in Arizona. He managed to, you know, return every question back to that, back to those subjects. You know, I like interviewing him. I mean, it was different from, it was a different experience in the doing it for the book than for a newspaper for a number of different reasons, but he's a fun subject to interview in the sense of like, I mean, we sat down on the couch in the main lobby of Mar-a-Lago, the main entrance room.
Where right everyone before, could see you, right?
Correct. Well, that's exactly right. Right before the dinner hour.
Oh, of course.
So as people were coming in, he would point to me and you know, wave and acknowledge the people and point to me and say, hey, I got the Wall Street Journal here.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. Like somehow my presence would validate the man who was, you know, the 45th president of the United States. But, you know, he was in this sort of transition moment, which I, you know, describe at length in the book as kind of from the leader of the free world to what I call the king of Palm Beach. Right. And he's getting, you know, he has dinner every night out on the terrace at Mar-a-Lago, surrounded by dues paying members. When he waits until they're all seated to come out, gets a standing ovation.
Oh, God.
When he comes in, gets a standing ovation when he leaves. And this is kind of what helped it bring him, give him some sense of, I mean, it's what sort of supplemented the rallies for him.
We didn't even get into the rallies. I wanted to go there because you opened the book talking about this community. It reminds me of the Deadhead community. I come from rock radio.
Yeah.
But these people lived for these rallies and they hold him up as a rock star. And that to me is what propelled his victory.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Nicole, I appreciate you bringing it up. I mean, I do think that, you can fill an entire library with Trump books, right? In the 30, 40 years he's been in the public eye. What's different about this book up to now, of any other books that have been written about Trump up to now, and the ones that are going to come out this year, is this is the only one that will go behind the scenes inside the Oval Office, is a fly on the wall for major campaign decisions and campaign memos exclusively reported here for the first time on how they're making spending decisions and hiring decisions and spent $2 billion and still chasing Biden by the end of the year. And thirdly, and I think most unique is that I effectively embedded for 2 years with some of Trump's most loyal supporters, the men and women who go to 30, 40, and really, I'm not kidding, 50, 60 rallies, to understand them and why, what about them kept them coming back over and over and over again, what it was about Trump that kept them coming back. And I think this is, it was important for me to understand that and understanding the movement at the time, but I think is an even more pressing question now as, you know, post January 6th, you know, Trump brought several thousand people to Ohio for a rally last month.
Yeah.
In Florida, he drew several thousand more, you know, and to try to understand why these folks keep coming back.
And you even point out that they've heard this, they've heard it over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's like the greatest hits. He rambles on and says nothing, and people get up and leave in the middle. But when you mm-hmm. ask them about it, they're like, oh, he's great. He's wonderful. Yeah. We love him. But yeah. I guess it's time to go home because they have to travel to the next city for the next rally.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there is some of it's personal, some of it's political, some of it's, you know, about Trump himself. I mean, they feel like he gives them a voice and you know, in some kind of touching ways, like not just politically. I talked to people who said after they, you know, started following Trump, they stand up for themselves at work.
Oh, right. My God.
And, you know, speak up for themselves in relationships and, you know, but what the book details is, you know, how badly they were, you know, were misled over the course of 2020 to some pretty catastrophic and in some instances fatal consequences.
It just brings life to the old adage. There's a sucker born every minute. Mm. I feel sorry for these people for not having a life and not knowing enough that they've been scammed, that this man is a con man. And they've been taken in. And it just blows my mind that he's got that power over so many people, but it's undeniable. Michael C. Bender, I could keep going on with you for a while. We've already run over. So we're in overtime now. Thank you so much. The book is wonderful. It's called Frankly, We Did Win This Election, The Inside Story of How Trump Lost. And I say it's wonderful. It's frightening. But it's important to know what went on to hopefully protect us from anything like this ever happening again. Unfortunately, I don't think we're at that place yet. I think we're very vulnerable again.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm really glad you you enjoyed the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to meet you. I appreciate it.
Take care. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. There you have it. And we are done for the day. And also, don't forget, we got a fun video thing going on here. I'm going to run now because I'm in for Brad Friedman tonight. I'm repurposing the interview I did with Cory Doctorow last week because it was so good, but I got to get over and get that work done. So have a great weekend, everyone. If anyone needs a pet portrait done, contact me because I will not be at the thing this Sunday. I'll be here. Thanks for listening and have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday. And you take care and stay safe. Bye, everyone.